Okay, I want to talk about Buddhism today, and I understand you already know something about the Hare Krishnas, a form of Hinduism. And the Buddha was a Hindu, in the same way Jesus was a Jew, but after the Buddha died, we actually had something called Buddhism come up into the world. And there are three kinds of Buddhism. There's not just one, there are three kinds: Theravada, Doctrine of the Elders; Mahayana, the Great Vehicle; Vajrayana, the Diamond Vehicle. So Vajrayana is Tibetan Buddhism, and Mahayana Buddhism is like Zen and Pure Land, and Theravada Buddhism is the early Buddhism. They are the Orthodox Buddhists. They're like the Catholics, and Mahayana is like the Protestants. So it's interesting to go in and study this and to see what makes it work. So to oversimplify it, which I'm going to do today, it's like, okay, how can we understand Buddhism in a way that I can apply to everyday life? And so you can approach Buddhism in a variety of ways, but I like one: personal discipline, mental purification, and wisdom. That is a way to understand Buddhism and apply it to your life. So we have personal discipline. And if you're a Buddhist, you take something called the five precepts. The five precepts are a way to discipline what you say and what you do. So the first precept is, I will practice not to take life. And the idea of practice is really important because we realize that we're not there yet. That killing is really a fast solution to a problem, especially if it's like mosquitoes, flies, or cockroaches. All you got to do is kill them, and that's taken care of. But as a Buddhist, we understand that life is really important, and it's really hard to be born. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about it in this way, but you were not here on Earth forever. Now you're here, and if you're lucky, you got 60, 70, 80 years, and you'll never be here again. So how remarkable is it that you were born in the first place? That two people in all the world, 7 billion people, found each other and liked each other enough to have you. And they didn't even know who you were. They just loved each other. And then you showed up. And now they had to deal with you. Very expensive. You know, children are expensive. You got school. You got cars, you got college tuition, a lot of stuff. And yet, parents are remarkable in the way that they look at that as not a burden, but as a blessing. So as a Buddhist, the first precept, not to kill. I find it takes a lot more time not to kill. So for instance, you get a mosquito, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, you don't want the mosquito in your room. You've taken a vow not to kill or take life. So you get up and you get a jar and you go and catch the mosquito and you take the little guy outside and let him go. And it could take 20 minutes. It could take 45 minutes. And now you try to get back to sleep and it takes you an hour to get back to sleep. And look how much time you spent just to save that little life. Wow. And you could have killed it, but you didn't. So I would recommend, if you want to practice not killing, tomorrow morning, wake up and say, today, I'm not taking anybody out. And you leave your house with confidence that you won't kill any human beings. And when you get good at not killing human beings, then you add lions and tigers and bears. And I live in downtown Los Angeles, and we don't have those. So it's really easy not to kill them. And then you add cockroaches, mosquitoes, flies, spiders, all those little insects, ants in the kitchen. Wow. You practice not killing them. It's a great practice. And one day that practice turns into performance. You don't even have to think about it anymore. You don't kill. So your buddy says, hey, let's go fishing. And you say, fishing? I'm not going to go kill fish. That's no fun. Oh, we'll get some beer, we'll be on the lake, it'll be a wonderful day, we'll have all those dead fish, we get to take pictures of how many fish we killed, won't it be wonderful? And you go, no, I don't want to go kill fish. Well, let's go hunting then. We'll kill deers and bears. No, I don't want to do that either. So as you change, because you've taken that first precept, some of your friends may change too. Because they may not be working on that and see the importance of not killing. Number two, second precept. I will not take what is not given. Well, it's a little different than not stealing. Because it's like you're in Denny's, you just got a hamburger, there's ketchup on the table, and you ask the waitress if it's okay to use the ketchup because she didn't offer to you. And the waitress says, that's what it's there for. What's wrong with you? And you say, well, I'm just trying to be a Buddhist, that's all. And she walks away shaking her head, those Buddhists. And then you use the ketchup because she offered it to you. So it's like, okay, I'm not going to take what is not given. I'm not going to use it if it's not given. If I need a pen and then somebody leaves a pen behind, I'm not going to use it because it wasn't offered to me. Number three, no sexual misconduct. This is a tough one. I know you're all trying to figure that out right now. And in L.A., everything is okay. But is it really? What did the Buddha say about sexual misconduct? He said there are a couple of things you shouldn't do. Why? Not because it's wrong. Because it causes more suffering, not less suffering. See, that's the reference point, suffering. So what can I do to cause less suffering? Number one, don't have sex with people that are married, because that causes a lot of suffering. And these two people have come together in love and kindness, and you don't want to wreck that relationship. You know, it's hard enough without people trying to take your mate away. So, don't have sex with people that are married. Don't have sex with people who are engaged, because they're going to be married. And you don't want them to second guess this whole thing. Weddings are expensive. You don't want them dropping out just before wedding day. So stay away from people that are engaged. And number three, don't have sex with people against their will. That's the big one. And that's the one that I think we can say is important. And that's it. That's all the Buddha said. So can you have a healthy sex life and follow those three things? I think you can. I think it works out fine. And you might ask the monk or the nun, well, why don't you guys have sex? What's the problem with sex that the Buddha said, if you're a monk or nun, you can't have it anymore? Well, two reasons. Reason number one, it costs a lot of money to have sex. You're going to spend a fortune on dating, maybe getting married, going to strip clubs. It's a lot of money. He said, you are now a monastic, and you're going to be living in an economy of generosity. You're not going to be working. People are beginning to give you money. And when people give you money, you never know how much or when. So you can't afford to have a relationship. They're just too darn expensive. You go, wow, okay. But number two, the second reason, the most important reason. The most important reason monks and nuns don't have sex is because the ultimate goal is to be free. You're not going to be free if you have sex. You're not going to be free if you're in a relationship. Do most people care? They don't care. The prison of relationship is a wonderful place to be. You'll be in love. You'll be happy. You'll be satisfied. You'll be fulfilled. You just won't be free. And free from what? Free from suffering. You won't be free from suffering if you're in a relationship. There's always going to be suffering. Two people get together, there's suffering. Happiness too, bliss too, love too, suffering too. Number four, fourth precept is not to speak unskillfully. Language is really important. People get into a lot of trouble with language. So you don't want false speech, malicious speech, harsh speech, gossip or idle chatter. You want to avoid those things. You don't want to watch TMZ anymore. You don't want to gossip with your friends and idle chatter. So what are you going to talk about? Yeah, you don't talk about much of anything. Maybe the cat's hungry and you should feed it. You know? But you're going to have wholesome conversations which benefit each person who's talking and listening. Number five, fifth precept, hardest one of all. Number five, I will practice not getting high. Really? Come on. This is 2019. You can go to Hollywood to a cafe and sit down with a burger and a joint. How cool is that? You can get high in public now. You can go down to your local, pot store and get a variety of pot. Or you can go to the bar and you can get a variety of liquor and drink. So what's wrong with getting high? Haven't humans been doing that ever since they were humans in the world? Yes, they have. But as a Buddhist, we say the problem with getting high is it steals your wisdom. You end up doing dumb things and you suffer more, not less. That's all. It's about wisdom. You can go to UCLA, get a master's degree, have a case of beer, and not remember anything. One case of beer can steal your whole education for a few hours, maybe a few days. So we try to avoid consuming intoxicants. Now people say, but how about medicine? How about if your doctor gives you a prescription for marijuana because you have back pain or something else? And that's fine. The Buddha said, medicine is a necessity. But getting high isn't. Okay, so that's the personal discipline part. Five precepts. Every official Buddhist takes those five precepts, tries to practice them every day. And you know what? Their life is better because of it. Now we come to meditation, cultivation of the mind. What a rascal the mind is, huh? It seems to have a mind of its own sometimes. Okay, so what is meditation? Meditation is sitting quietly waiting for enlightenment. There you are. You're just sitting there waiting for enlightenment. Sometimes it takes 10 years, 20 years of waiting, sometimes a couple lifetimes of waiting. And we have meditation techniques that allow us to do something while we're waiting for enlightenment. And there's a book called the Visuddhimagga, The Path of Purification, written in the 5th century. And it states there are 44 different kinds of meditation that a Buddhist can do. 40 kinds of tranquility meditation and 4 kinds of insight meditation. So we have samatha, tranquility, we have vipassana, insight. The Buddha rediscovered insight meditation. It had been lost to the world. The 27 Buddhas before Siddhartha Gautama practiced insight meditation and achieved nirvana. So when the Buddha rediscovered insight meditation at the age of 35, he achieved nirvana. And he taught for 45 years only 2 things. So Buddhism, if you want to break it down in the simplest way, is Buddhism is only about 2 things, always and forever. Number 1, why we suffer. Number 2, how to end suffering. That's it. We talk about why we suffer, and then we talk about how to end it. Do we talk about God? No, we don't. And that disappoints a lot of people, because God's important in most religions. But you know what? We found that God is not going to end suffering, for whatever reason. And his only son ended on the cross. Jeez. So we don't blame God for suffering. We don't blame Jesus for suffering. We don't ask God to end our suffering. We don't ask Jesus to end our suffering. We say to ourselves, I guess I'm going to have to do it myself. And that's where Buddhism comes in. 100 books on how to end suffering. So let's talk about samatha meditation first. Samatha meditation is tranquility meditation. Samatha meditation deals with extreme focus and concentration on the object of meditation. And let's say we chose the breath as our object of meditation. And we're going to follow the breath. and we bring our attention to the tip of the nose, and we feel it going out and coming in, going out and coming in. And we say to our mind, mind, I want you to follow the breath. And the mind says, I don't want to do it because it's really boring. I want to think about tomorrow. I want to think about lunch. I want to think about yesterday. I'm not going to watch the breath. What good is that? And then you say, mind, I'm in charge. And the mind says, you think you're in charge. But I'm driven by desire and craving and attachment and aversion. These are wonderful things that I do for you because I'm the master. And you go, mind, you're not the master. You're the servant. Mind as master is not good. Mind as servant is very good. So this is what I'm going to do for you, mind. I'm going to give you something to think about while you're watching the breath. I want you to count. I want you to use the concept of numbers. And I want you to attach numbers to the sensation of breath. So when I exhale, I want you to say one. When I inhale, I want you to say two, up to 10, down to one, up to 10, down to one. I don't want you multiplying. I don't want you adding. I just want you to count 1 to 10, 10 to 1. And given enough time, the mind starts to feel comfortable with counting, counting the breath, using concepts as a tether to the sensation of breath. Now you're getting good. I counted my breath for 2 years. It took me 2 years to get good at counting 1 to 10, 10 to 1. But I succeeded. Then I said, I'm going to stop counting. I'm just going to use my mind as a way of becoming aware of my breath. But no concepts. I'm going to let go of the concepts. And what did that do for me? That allowed me to come to the present moment experience of my life. Because any sensation you become aware of is happening right now. Not a thought, it's not a wish, it's happening right now. So if you have sore feet right now, it's right now. If you have a bad back right now, it's right now. So I came to the sensation of breath, which was right now, and that was the doorway to the present moment experience of my life without past or future. And what did I come to understand? I came to understand that we have 6 sense doors, not 5. We have sight, we have sound, we have smell, we have taste, we have touch, and we have thinking. And if you use those sense doors as the basis for your reality, you can actually watch concepts arise, exist, and pass away. So I live in Koreatown, downtown Los Angeles. We just had 28 cars with their tires punctured one night. Some guy with a knife, bang, bang, bang. It's a wonderful place to live. And we have helicopters every day and all night flying, crisscrossing Koreatown, keeping us safe. And now I hear the sound of the helicopter in meditation. My eardrum is vibrating. And what happens? All of a sudden, this picture of a helicopter arises in my mind. It's black and white. It must be a police helicopter. And they must be chasing a bad guy. So now the story starts to happen. The police helicopter is chasing a bad guy, and it's just a matter of time until they catch him and take him to jail. And then the gong rings, and meditation is over. And I went, wow! Eardrum vibrated, and all that stuff happened? What an amazing event to be a human being. And we do that every day, every moment. Right now, you are experiencing an amazing hallucination. Because none of this stuff you're experiencing is really happening the way you think it is. We each have our own little world we live in. And our mind, the master, is creating it moment by moment. Sometimes we're the victor, sometimes we're the victim. Sometimes it's a cool story, sometimes it's a boring story. Man, So we don't need to take drugs. We just need to live and hallucinate and make this reality. Classroom, teacher, presenter, not what you think. It's form, sound, smell, taste, touch, thinking. That's what it is. That's what's happening right now. But we've been given the gift of creating stories. A beginning, a middle, and an end. And I tell you what, life has no beginning, according to Buddhism. It's always been there, always will be there. Just keeps rolling right along. You are not the most important thing in the world to life. To you, you are. But to life, no, you're just one of the players. You're here for a little while, and then life goes on. So don't get too attached, the Buddha would say. Don't get too attached, because everything will be taken away from you eventually. Everything. And all you have to do is get old, and you'll see it slowly being taken away, day by day. Memory, enthusiasm, energy, this goes away. All that strength you had at 25, man, you could lift 200, 300 pounds. You get to be 80, you barely can lift a shoe off the ground. Where did it go? What happened? Well, we're getting there. So we have this meditation, and now we have this deep sense of concentration, and there is something called the four jhanas. The four jhanas are four different levels of concentration. So in the first jhana, we have five aspects: applied thought, sustained thought, happiness, bliss, and equanimity. Those are the five characteristics of the first jhana. So what does that mean? It means applied thought and sustained thought. We have our breath as the object of meditation. We apply our thought and we hold it there, either through counting or will, and that's applied thought and sustained thought. And after a while, after doing it a multitude of times, it just automatically stays there. So you get rid of the applied thought and sustained thought, you go into the second jhana, and now you have three characteristics: bliss, happiness, and equanimity. And in order to go to the next jhana, the next level of tranquility, you have to give something up. And what you're going to give up is bliss and pleasure. Well, how do you give up bliss and pleasure? Because you don't have much to do with it. It just sort of happens, and you enjoy it. Well, what you really give up is your attachment to bliss and pleasure. Your attachment. And when you do that, you're simultaneously giving up pain. How about that? If I give up pleasure, I give up pain too. And nobody wants pain, and everybody wants pleasure. So how do you give up pleasure? I haven't figured that out yet. But there is a way to give up pain. Two ways to give up pain. Next time you're in a bunch of pain, say to yourself, I'm going to be the pain. There'll be no separation. It'll just be a really strong sensation. I won't be there to experience it. It'll just be happening, and it won't be a problem. Theoretically, that's a wonderful way of looking at it, but I haven't found that that works very well. Because when I'm just the pain, it still hurts. So, the other way is to anesthetize the pain. So say you're sitting in meditation and your knee starts to hurt and you go, I don't know if I can make it through the whole session because my knee really hurts. And what you start to do is concentrate even more on your object of meditation. And that allows you then to not feel the pain quite as much. And you can imagine maybe in a real life situation, you're in a movie, you're watching the Joker. It's a really interesting and scary scene, and you don't realize your arm fell asleep because the movie is so exciting that it took all your attention. And after the scene is over, you look at your arm and it's dangling because there's no blood in it. You go, wow. So that's sort of how you anesthetize pain, by focusing so vigorously on your object of meditation. Okay, so now we're at the second jhana. We want to go to the third jhana. We have to give something else up. What are we going to give up, happiness or equanimity? Well, we're going to give up our attachment to happiness and our aversion to sadness. because happiness and sadness, pleasure and pain, really agitate the mind. It doesn't allow our consciousness to be peaceful and settled. So now I'm going to give up my attachment to happiness, my aversion to unhappiness. I'll have one characteristic left. That'll be equanimity, perfect balance of mind, no preferences, choiceless awareness. Okay, when you get there, there is no pain, there is no pleasure, there is no happiness, there is no sadness, there's just existence. And there you are. And that's the ideal in Buddhism, is to get to that place and make it permanent. Then your life is not a problem at that point. There's nothing in your life that will be a problem because you have transcended all the little stuff that always gives you suffering, pain, pleasure, happiness, unhappiness. So theoretically, that's really cool and fairly easy to understand, and it takes a lifetime, if not more, to get to that kind of equanimity. So now we have vipassana, insight meditation. There are four kinds of vipassana, insight meditation: mindfulness of the body, mindfulness of sensations, mindfulness of the mind, mindfulness of mental objects. So I'm going to talk about mindfulness of sensations and the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom that allow us to become free from suffering. So how many sensations do we have as a human being? The answer is we have three. Oh, it's so simple. We have good sensations, we have bad sensations, we have neutral sensations. Most of us aren't going to be aware of the neutral sensations, but the good and bad sensations catch our attention. And we're going to sit on the floor like we did with our tranquility meditation, and we're going to scan from the top of the head to the tip of the toes, up and down, looking for sensations, good sensations, bad sensations. My knee hurts, bad sensation, I found one. Okay, noted, and now we continue. Oh, my back's not working very well. Noted, and we keep looking. Wow, this room is really cold. I'm uncomfortable. Ah, bad sensation, okay, noted. No good sensations. Good sensations take a lot of meditation time to happen. In the beginning, it's not a pleasant experience. There's optimistic, there's pessimistic, and there is realistic. And what happens in meditation is you become the realistic experiencer of your world. Experience of your world. Okay, so now you've got all these negative sensations, and now you're going to use the three aspects of Buddhist wisdom to understand them and see if they apply to the world around you. Anicca, dukkha, anatta, Pali, ancient language of early Buddhism. Anicca, impermanence. You say to yourself, were all these sensations impermanent, or did they seem to last and not change much and have the same intensity? And you would probably come to the conclusion that no, you know, some hurt more than others. Didn't seem to be the same very long. Sometimes it got better, sometimes it got worse. But they were always changing. Some even seemed to go away for a while. But then they would come back again in a different way. So you have to say, because of these sensations, I now understand that everything in my body and in my mind is impermanent and always changing. Now you take that insight and you apply it to the world around you. And you say, is there anything in the world that doesn't change? Even one thing. Is there one thing in the world that doesn't change? And you say to yourself, no, there isn't. Everything in the world changes all the time. I went to Disneyland the other day and they closed. They didn't even stay open all the time. Wow. And you're driving on the freeway, and sometimes there's a lot of traffic, and sometimes not too much traffic. And you go, man, it's always changing. And relationships, wow, volatile. You know, one good day, two bad days. You go, man, you know. And then you feed the cat, and the cat didn't want the food. And you go, man, cat, you always ate this food. What's wrong with you today? Even cats change, but slowly. And then you go, okay, so if everything in the world is always changing, what am I going to hold on to? What's going to be my basis for happiness if everything is always changing? And you realize you can't cling to anything in the world, and you can't cling to anything in yourself, body or mind, because it's always changing, and you're going to be disappointed when it does, or it doesn't change fast enough, and you're disappointed because of that. You go, okay, wow. A good lesson, a hard lesson to really appreciate. Second one, dukkha. Everything is ultimately unsatisfactory. Now, Bryce might say, well, that's a little pessimistic, Kusala. Because not everything is always unsatisfactory. But ultimately, it will be unsatisfactory. Why? Because everything changes. So all the good stuff that you really like in your life won't be there forever. Sometimes it goes really fast. Sometimes it hangs around for a while. You know? How about that new car that you really want? Can hardly wait to buy? Maybe the Charger. 4,000 horsepower. Man, that'd be so much fun to have. But somebody's going to key it, or you're going to wreck it, or mechanically it's going to go south, or you're going to want the latest edition. You go, oh, man, that was the perfect car, too. I was so happy for 6 months, and now I'm not happy anymore. I got to get something else. The new iPhone just came out. 3 camera lenses. Well, the one you have now was just one. How can you be happy with that? Apple's counting on it, that you're not going to be happy, and that you'll want the one with 3 lenses, because you'll be able to take wide-angle, telephoto, or regular pictures with your camera. How about a camera instead, with different lenses? They actually still sell cameras, and they have some really cool lenses, and it'll do a lot more than the iPhone, except it won't make calls. But that might be okay. So everything ultimately will be unsatisfactory because everything changes. Now, last but not least, this aspect of Buddhist wisdom is the most difficult to understand. That we are not who we think we are. We do not have an independent self. We do not have an independent soul. This is difficult. Because most people want a soul. Even if they don't know what the heck it is or what it looks like, it sounds good to have a soul. And you might even have a soulmate out there someplace that you could share your soul with. And the Buddha said, I have looked carefully in mind and body. I have not found anything that is independent. I have only found process. You are not an event. You are a process. Well, if we don't have a soul, how can we get reborn and reincarnated? You might say to yourself, if you're into reincarnation and rebirth. Well, the Buddha said, it's not the soul that migrates lifetime to lifetime. It is your karmic energy. That's what goes lifetime to lifetime. And you go, karmic energy? What the heck is that? So let me digress for a moment and talk about karma. Karma is everything you think, say, and do. What you think, what you say, and what you do is your karma. And you are transforming neutral energy and giving it a moral value. So the world is filled with energy. Even Einstein said that. And you can't create energy, and you can't destroy energy, but you can transform energy. So think of yourself as a karma transformer. You know, and you're going through there and you say something a little unskillful that hurts people's feelings. And what you've done now is you've changed the energy and give it a negative value. You were unskillful. But what happens if you were kind to someone and said some kind words and even some kind actions? You were a karma transformer, and you did it in such a skillful way, you created good energy in the world. And because energy can't be destroyed, it gets transferred from lifetime to lifetime. It's sort of like a boat with a motor and a wake. And the boat sinks, and the wake then gets attached to another boat. Interesting. So sometimes we're born because we have good karma, and sometimes we're born because we have bad karma. So how does rebirth work in Buddhism? If you don't have a soul, what happens? You have a sperm, you have an egg, and you have karmic energy. And when those three things come together, life begins. According to Buddhism, life begins. Okay, so now you had some good karma, and you're born in Palos Verdes. And maybe you had some not so good karma, and you're born in Koreatown. That's just the beginning, because now it's up to you to continue the karmic process and have a good life by being skillful in what you think, what you say, and what you do. It's a lot of energy to have a good life. It's not necessarily about money, though money is important, and we need money to exist, but it's also important to say the right thing, do the right thing, and think the right thing. You'll have an even better life that way. Okay, so now we're taking this stuff and we go, okay, but how about this personality thing? Because I know I have a personality and it feels like me and people keep recognizing me and talking to me like they know me. So there must be a continuum there. I must be recognizable. And you are. But every moment in your life, every moment in your day-to-day, you are becoming a new and different person. Because of experiences, because of time, and impermanence. So the person that walked through that door to come to this class today will not be the same person who leaves. And you may not feel the difference, and people may not see the difference, but there is a difference. And after 10 years, you look in the mirror and you go, whoa, what the hell happened? And after 20 or 30 years, you look in the mirror and you go, man, I don't know who this guy is. He's not the one that started this journey, but he's the one that's in it now. So I've often thought of life as being like a relay race, and we have that baton, and we keep handing off to the next person who's going to be us. And I often tell people, when they ask me if I'm busy, I say to them, I got places to go, and I got people to be. So who am I going to be tomorrow? I'll find out tomorrow. How about that? You know what that means? That means your life is so exciting because you really don't know what's going to happen next. You think you do. You think you've had this experience before, but it is always the first time, and that makes life exciting. You know, we can't get bored with life because life is just one thing after the other that's new and fresh and just beginning. How cool is that? Even when you're old, it's still the first time. You know? Well, how do you feel today? Well, I feel good right now, but I'm not sure about tomorrow. Okay, how cool is that? You're alive. That means you're living. So there is no independent self, according to Buddhism, that is who we are. Rather, we have a process that is constantly changing and updating, and we are new people all the time. So there's no fixed, independent, unconditional self or soul, according to Buddhism. Always a process. And what does that mean to you, the one who is suffering? That means that there is no one to suffer. When you really understand it, when it becomes more than practice and becomes performance, you realize there is no one to suffer and there is nothing to hold on to because everything is changing. It's an illusion that we're holding on, it's an illusion that we're somebody. So the somebody becomes our servant, not our master. And it takes a long time to get to that place in your practice where you don't listen to your thinking as being the ultimate truth. Where you listen to your thinking as just thinking. Just words. Words happening because of an environment I'm in, a circumstance I'm in, a situation I'm in, just words. We don't have to be those words. We don't have to have those feelings. It's up to us. That's the freedom of Buddhism. We can be who we want to be because we're nobody. That gives us permission to be anybody we want to be. How cool is that? You can be a great guitar player. You can be a physicist, a scientist that gets the Nobel Prize. Because you're nobody, And you can be somebody, and all it takes is a little practice and a little work. No limitations. I like that idea. I felt good about that when I finally understood it. That every morning I wake up, it's the first day of my life, and who am I going to be today? And some people will look at you and they'll tell you who you are. But that's them. That's not you. That's how they see you. And they don't know you. They don't know the inner workings of you, the magic that happens. And you might say to them, no, I'm sorry, you're wrong. That's not who I am today. I was that yesterday. And I got tired of it. I don't want to be that anymore. I want to be who I am today. Because life gives me infinite possibilities to be anybody I want to be. And at that point, you never have to suffer again. So we have enlightenment, we have nirvana. I have found that they are two different things. So let me explain enlightenment to you. Enlightenment is the direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. Now, when you first hear that, it probably doesn't make much sense. The direct experience of the interconnectedness and interdependence of all phenomena. But what that means is this, that you do not exist independently, you are conditional, and in order to change something, you need to change conditions, not yourself. That's enlightenment. But the downside of realizing that you're connected to everybody is, if there's somebody suffering, like the 20,000 homeless people in Los Angeles, it's really part of you that's suffering too. Because you're connected to them whether you want to be or not. So in order to end their suffering and your suffering, you have to help them. You've come to the point now where you don't need to help yourself anymore. You're enlightened. But everybody else now is causing you to suffer. So you need to end their suffering. And that's called the bodhisattva. Bodhisattva ideal. I want to save all sentient beings from suffering. How long does that take to save all sentient beings from suffering? It takes forever. Because we keep having more people. So there's more people suffering. So you get three people not suffering, and you get five more that are. And you go, man. But you continue to do it because Buddhism is about suffering and the end of suffering. Now there's something called an arhat, which is nirvana. Nirvana I define in this way. It's the end of suffering in this lifetime. It's the end of karma. And it's the end of all future rebirth. So I already talked about suffering. I talked about karma, and karma is what migrates lifetime to lifetime. So if you end your karma, you'll never be reborn again. Now, this is a tough sell. Because I'm not talking about non-existence. I'm talking about existence that doesn't include birth. Everything on earth, everything we've ever experienced, had a beginning. And we call that oftentimes birth. But because of birth, everything has to die. So while we like birth, we don't like death, and we'd be nice to not have to die. And in order not to die, according to Buddhism, the secret is not to be born. Whoa! But how do you exist without being born? And I think the Buddha figured it out. I think he said that I exist because of nirvana, not because of birth. And nirvana is unending. No beginning, no end, no suffering. So an arhat, someone who has achieved nirvana, exists in a very special way while they're alive and exists in an even more special way after they die. So they exist, but not because of birth. Because of nirvana. Now, this took me a long time to figure out because everybody is so happy when the little baby comes into the world. And you know what I see now when I see a little baby come into the world? I see 70 years of suffering for that little baby. And they have parties, and they have little clothes, and I'm thinking, oh man, you know, that little guy, he's coming into a world that will not give him a break. You know? But I usually don't talk about it because nobody wants to hear it. And when I do a wedding, I did one a couple weeks ago, I'm a little sad about that too. Because you know what the problem is with a wedding? Everything changes. You know? So will I get a call for the divorce? I don't know. We'll have to see. So we have birth, we have death, we have weddings, we have divorce, we have all sorts of duality in the world. We have no suffering, we have a lot of suffering, but all two sides of the same coin. And I've often thought what happens in Buddhism is we become the coin, not one side or the other. So we work hard. We take the five precepts, we meditate, we use those three aspects of Buddhist wisdom to try to understand the world around us. And then one day, while we're waiting in the zendo on a cushion, nirvana happens. It was always there. We didn't have to go any other place. It was always there. It's always inside each and every one of us. And one day when the conditions are correct, and what we're doing in meditation and following the precepts, it was trying to make the conditions correct for nirvana to occur.